They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Chris Pinto. And Chris is a video, a DVD producer. He's done some of the finest work that I've ever seen. It certainly is far better than much of what you're going to see on History Club or the Discovery Channel, and the difference is that this is true. So much of what they put up there is slanted not to reveal but to conceal the truth, and Chris's work going into the background. Well, the first DVD that we had, of course, we had Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, and others had done, but the first in the Secret Mystery series was The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. The second was Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And the third DVD in the series was entitled Riddles. It was entitled The Eye of the Phoenix. And if you haven't seen it, you really need to see it. But I asked Chris if he'd talk tonight about the second in the series, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, because it's very difficult for the average individual to understand or to believe that there was a strong occult influence at the time that Washington, D.C. was laid out in the late 1790s, and that if you go to Washington, D.C. today and look in many of our major buildings there, you'll find all sorts of occult statues. You will find certainly the designs of the Zodiac there displayed. What is the signs of the Zodiac having to do with our nation's capital? It has absolutely nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with it. Because, of course, these secrets and occult societies have been here since the beginning. Chris, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's great to be back on the show, Dr. Stan. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how did you get interested in the fact that there was an occult background not only to the design of our nation's capital, but to so many of the statues, many of the buildings, many of the pictures and paintings that are there.
Well, I guess like a lot of researchers who research the New World Order, it's information that you come across in terms of, you know, the layout and the design for Washington, D.C. There's a lot of websites out there. There's a number of books that have been written about it. You've got books written by people who are trying to expose the occult workings of these secret societies and their plan to build the New World Order. And then you've got certain esoteric authors who are actually Freemasons or members of Rosicrucianism or other arcane groups who have written books about it, people like David Ovison. And, of course, we quote Ovison's book in the film. Ovison wrote a huge 500-600-page book on the, you know, the architecture of D.C., and he's culling out from all of the zodiacs and everything what he believes is the, you know, the inner working of the symbolism and so on. Now, it's very important to bring up Ovison's work because Ovison is himself a Freemason, and the introduction to his book was written by one of the most prominent Masons of the 20th century, a guy named C. Fred Kleinkenecht. So those are some of the elements that we bring in, and we try to cite their writings to show people that this is what they believe about the architecture and the symbolism there.
And the symbolism is there, and once, of course, it's pointed out to you why it's so obvious, but what people do not understand is these people hide their emblems in plain sight, and most people aren't going to recognize them. But, of course, those people who have studied the occult, those people who are disciples, and certainly people who are adepts of the occult understand it. They see it regularly. We've interviewed some of them, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But they understand. It's just that the average American has no idea. Well, you actually had an opportunity to get into a lot of the buildings there and have people actually show you around who really knew what it was all about, didn't you?
Yeah, in fact, we took two trips to D.C. We took the first trip. We had gotten permission from the D.C. Park Services Commission, whoever they are, that has authority over the city itself. And when we were there several years ago, there was still just a tremendous amount of security all over the place because of the post 9/11 environment. And so everywhere we went to do any filming at all, we were stopped by police officers throughout the day. And so we shot all of the outside buildings and monuments and things like that. and were back for about a month or so, and then we were contacted by a Christian guy named Tony, who is a cop, a police officer. He works inside the U.S. Capitol, and he had contacted us, said he was a Christian. He'd been following the progress of our series, and he asked if we had had an opportunity to actually get inside any of the buildings there. And we said, no, we hadn't been able to do that because the security was so tight. And he said, well, what if I could get you inside some of these buildings? Would you bring a camera and do some filming? And I said, well, yeah, no doubt. And so I was allowed to go in with a camera, and, you know, and he gave me a guided tour, not only inside the U.S. Capitol, but inside the Library of Congress and a number of other key buildings. And so we just ended up with a very rich amount of very colorful, very powerful and unique footage that I've never seen in any other documentary, but we were able to put it in Riddles and Stone. And Tony had some great insights as well into, because he had, you know, he's there every day. He's in the city, and he told us, and has said so repeatedly, that people who live in D.C. who are recognizing what's happening in the world, they see the strange things going on with our government and, you know, with our economy and the collapse and everything, and, you know, Obama's rise to power and the whole thing. They're asking more and more questions and looking into these things more deeply. And they were very surprised at some of the answers we were able to provide in Riddles and Stone. But a lot of those answers come from the Freemasons themselves, from these secret groups and their key philosophers and writers and authors and so on, who talk about this symbolism. And once you understand sort of the key to why they're doing what they're doing, and what all of this symbolism is pointing toward, it becomes...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris was just telling about how they got into some of the major buildings back in Washington, D.C., and got wonderful footage there that you won't see elsewhere. Now, this is in their DVD, The Riddles in Stone, going into the secret architecture of our nation's capital. And Chris was talking about how many of the people who live in Washington, D.C., who see what's going on, who see, you know, this move towards this one world government that's prophesied and in the scriptures, and then, of course, they're beginning to ask about what is really happening behind the scenes. A lot of people are saying, well, how did Obama get to be the president? Is there a force behind President Obama? I would just comment that those of you who have not yet seen my new talk on the financial Armageddon, of course, we talk about President Obama and the force behind President Obama, and of course most people are totally unaware that he was picked a long time ago for where he is going, and people throughout the world from the dark side had been actually praying that he would become the President of the United States at this time. We'll give you the sources of reference under any circumstances. That's a different subject, but that is our talk on the Financial Armageddon. It's a DVD, comes with a syllabus. You need to have the information, but pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, we learned a lot. What I looked for when I was doing the research for this was trying to find, because, you know, I'd seen other videos that talk about D.C., read other books that talk about it, and I was really looking for some unique information that I hadn't seen anywhere else. And I think the key for me to understanding the layout of D.C. was twofold. One, that the people who designed it, Pierre L'Enfant, to some extent George Washington, and not a small amount of influence from Thomas Jefferson, but they all had a background in the classical pagan world, and they were all, whether they were directly Freemasons or they were closely associated with Masonry. When you get into L'Enfant and Jefferson, there's a lot of debate about that. There are many Masons today who say that both of those men were Freemasons. But anyway, when you get into their background and their influence, and you realize that the idea of designing a city in alignment with the stars and with constellations and so on, the idea being that you're drawing down the energy or the power of the heavens to empower your city and to make it a great city or to bring blessing and this kind of thing, that that's something that goes all the way back to the ancient world. It was practiced probably most notably by the Egyptians when they built the pyramids and all of their monuments and the sphinxes and so on. All of those things were placed in a very specific order. And not only what, you know, did the Egyptians do it that way, but the Greeks and the Romans as well. And this carried on into Europe throughout the Middle Ages. It's said that all of the cathedrals of Europe are supposedly built on what are called ley lines, which are these sort of power lines that run throughout the earth, so it's believed, and you know, by some people who are involved in the occult. And if you build something on a ley line, as it's called, then it's empowered supernaturally in some way or another. And so a lot of your grand structures throughout Europe were built according to these principles in terms of, you know, what direction they're facing, how, you know, they align with the stars and so on. And so once you see it from that perspective, it's not so far-fetched to believe that men who had studied building and architecture and so on from that kind of a background would bring all of that experience and knowledge to the design of Washington, D.C. It makes all the sense in the world. And these were men who were trained, and they, you know, they were deeply involved in esotericism, at least. And so we talk about that in the film. But probably, according to Ovesen and other writers, the most dominant element is what is called hermeticism, the hermetic maxim, as above, so below. And that with the Pythagorean theorem. And the revolutionaries were heavily involved in the philosophies of Pythagoras during this time. And you can read about that in a book, I know a book that you've mentioned many times, Dr. Stan, Fire in the Minds of Men, by Dr. James Billington. And in that book, Billington writes about, he has a whole section in there called The Pythagorean Passion, and how the revolutionaries were, you know, deeply fascinated with Pythagoras. He became like the patron saint of the revolutionary cause. And he was, Pythagoras is said to have been the first, at least on record, to have ascribed to numbers and geometric shapes occult meanings, that a number had an inner meaning, that a shape, a triangle or a square or whatever, had some inner meaning.
And I think for our listeners, of course, Pythagoras was the father of modern-day geometry. And most people don't remember, but Pythagoras, you know, had come up and stated that A square plus B square equals C square. Now, that is the fundamental of geometry. The square root of the two sides of a right-angle triangle are equal to the square root of the hypotenuse of the triangle. And, you know, now remember, Pythagoras lived from about 560 A.D. to about 500 A.D. And it was during that period that he went from Greece to the Near East, where he came in touch with the mystics there and learned, of course, the secrets of the ancient mystery religions of the magi, of the magicians, of the seers of that era. Then, of course, returned and he set up a school where they taught the secrets of the mystery religions in Italy. It was on the east coast of Italy, on the Adriatic Ocean or Adriatic Sea. But Pythagoras then was really the beginning of this whole line of philosophers that two generations came up with, Socrates and then Plato and Aristotle, and then of course Alexander the Great, who was Aristotle's student. But they were all deeply involved in the mystical. Well, this is what most people don't understand, but everybody who goes to college has to take philosophy 1A. It's required in most colleges, and there you read Plato's Republic. And it goes right over the top of your head. You're never allowed really to understand it, but you read it. But there will be a few people who are able to see the mystical foundation that was being taught, you know, by Plato, what was that, about 260 years before Christ was born, about 250 years after Pythagoras. But you're absolutely right. James H. Billington, for our listeners, was the Librarian of Congress, He is the Librarian of Congress. He used to run the Smithsonian. He was a history professor. And he wrote this wonderful book about the secret societies. Now, of course, he doesn't talk about them much anymore, but, he's been well rewarded for what he's doing. But he doesn't talk about the secret societies, but his book, Fire in the Minds of Men, is certainly one of the five most important books in my library. And here, James H. Billington talks about this Pythagorean movement, which created a religious brotherhood, which created a series of secret societies, which led up and preceded the French Revolution in 1789. So you pick up the story there.
Yeah, in fact, we just to take it a step further, Dr. Stan, President George Bush, when he was reelected in 2005 for his second term, quoted from Dr. Billington's book, and he said, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men, saying it warms those that feel its power, it burns those who fight its progress, and one day this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world. Bush was aligning himself with the whole revolutionary movement that was intended to overwhelm the whole planet. Billington, of course, isn't talking about the American Revolution, although he does reveal some links between people like Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin with the Bavarian Illuminati, which is very interesting. But he's primarily talking about the influence of, the Bavarian Illuminati and how they then influenced all of the other revolutionaries who came afterward. But back to Pythagoras for a minute, two of the key symbols for Pythagoras were, as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, the triangle, the Pythagorean triangle, where you've got the two sides that are squared and equal then to the hypotenuse. And this is Federal Triangle in Washington, D.C. Federal Triangle is laid out as a Pythagorean triangle. And, of course, David Obison writes about this extensively in his book. And it's a symbol of the idea of the perfected man. The perpendicular side represents what they call the male principle. And you can read about this in Manly P. Hall's book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. In fact, he has a diagram, and we show it in the film. But he has a diagram showing the male principle plus the female principle, the base of the triangle squared equals the hypotenuse, which is the offspring of them both. And this is a symbol for their concept, the occult concept of a Christ figure, a perfected man. And it gets all the way into, ancient Kabbalah and the idea of alchemy, alchemia, and we talk about this, but divine alchemy is this idea, especially in Rosicrucianism, of the male and the female principle, which they consider to be like the light and the dark, the yin and the yang, and that these principles combine, and when they're perfected, they bring forth a perfected being. And this is the formula that you see repeated over and over and over again in a variety of ways in Washington, D.C.
But, of course, what does this all have to do with anything practical? It has everything to do with where we're headed. The whole idea is to bring about a one-world government, this perfect utopian society that, of course, Plato had written about in his book, The Republic. And, of course, they have created a financial crisis that is destroying the economy of the whole world because, of course, every country has to be forced into this new world system. The perfected system, perfected by mankind. We'll be right back in just a moment with Chris. Go right ahead, Chris. And really, it's fascinating. And most people don't have a glimpse of this. I know you've read about it extensively, and I'm just so glad that you're able to put so much of this into your film.
Well,
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Go to the Masons and you talk to them and they will be honest with you. They will explain to you that the nation's capital is just actually so much of the occult information is there, the occult symbology. We have a series of interviews with Mr. James Wasserman, a very nice man who'd been studying the occult for many years. He identifies with this, and he openly admits that, of course, the nation's capital suddenly contains all of these occult symbols. And, of course, the question is, why? Well, of course, people do not understand, and Christians do not like to admit. But when this country was founded, there were two forces. There was the Christian force and there was the occult force. And these two forces have been in conflict ever since. In fact, this dates back long before our country was founded to the very foundation of the Gnostic religion, because, of course, Masonry is simply a modern-day manifestation of Gnosticism. And the Gnostics believed that there were two gods. I mean, there was the God that the Christians worshipped, and then there was the real God, Lucifer. And that, of course, the God that they worshipped was the other God. And there was tremendous power to be had there if you could tap into the power of Lucifer. And the truth of the matter is, there really is. But you certainly don't want to be dabbling in that because it could cost you your eternal soul. So go ahead and pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, what's interesting, just to follow up on the pentagram, because I found this, we tried to dig out as much information on the pentagram that would have been known by the Masons who designed Washington, D.C., and during that time. Because a lot of the arguments are that the pentagram wasn't really even a prominent symbol, you know, an inverted pentagram until later in the 19th century. And that's provably false, and we talk about that. But anyway, we talk also about a very important guy, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the very famous German writer. And Goethe was a master mason. He was a very prominent master mason. In fact, if you go and research him today, the Masons have all this glowing praise for him. And they say that once he became a mason, everything that he wrote was just packed full of Masonic symbolism and allegory and so on. And of course, Goethe wrote the play Faust. Okay? And in the play Faust, he has Faust, when Faust summons Mephistopheles, the devil, he uses a pentagram to summon the devil. And it's not just any pentagram. It is an unfinished pentagram, a broken pentagram. And one of the things that we uncovered in our research was that this is a well-known symbol in the occult. And, of course, we document that through Manly P. Hall and his writings. He talks about the broken pentagram being used in black magic and so on as a very established symbol. We find that again now in Goethe. Goethe was not only a Mason, but he was also a member of the Bavarian Illuminati, and that's documented. People have written books about it. So he was involved with this whole European revolutionary a school of intellectuals who were, you know, rousing their imaginations to these grand ideas and notions of overthrowing kingdoms and everything, and the rights of man and all this kind of stuff. But he was also deeply involved in Masonic symbolism, to which all the Masons agree. And he published the first part of Faust, Faust ein Fragment, it's called, Faust a Fragment. 2 years before Pierre L'Enfant finished his street design for Washington, D.C. And, of course, L'Enfant came from France, so he would have had some, you know, being involved with the revolutionaries and the Masons and so on, and many people believe and have said for well over 100 years that L'Enfant was himself a Mason, which would make sense. Why would Washington, a Mason, hire or get somebody who was not a Mason to design America's capital? It just doesn't make any sense. But anyway, so L'Enfant then comes up with a street design, and in his original design, you see the pentagram there in the street design. But it's an unfinished pentagram. Rhode Island Avenue does not come all the way down to finish it, and so that's been you know, the main contention among certain Masonic apologists like Brent Morris and others, who have said, well, no, it's not intentional because it's an unfinished pentagram. So we talk about in the film why it's an unfinished pentagram, or at least present a very strong theory as to why it was an unfinished pentagram.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you go to, if you see Chris's film, you'll see all of the signs of the zodiac. And in fact, there's one major building back there where they have the zodiac painted on the ceiling on every floor. But of course, most people have no idea.
From the mall.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, I guess, this evening at Chris Pinto. And we're talking about the secret architecture of our nation's capital, because the last thing they want is for the Christians of this country to really understand what's happening and how these dark forces have been here in the past. In the past, they've been submerged. Today, they are in total working control of our government, determining our foreign policy, and using the financial and military power of the United States to bring about this new world order, which has been the goal of the secret societies for 5,000 years, really dating back to the time of Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. And so I think it's vitally important to people, if you have an opportunity to get and watch this DVD, tremendous information here, and then you begin to see how this whole pattern fits together. Certainly the Christian influence was predominant at the time our nation was established, but the occultists were here. Everything had to be done in secret. Most Americans, even today, don't understand that there are Rosicrucian chapters of the Rosicrucian secret society all across the United States. We have a Rosicrucian temple right in San Jose, just very close to where I live. And of course, there are chapters, branches, lodges of the Rosicrucians, which was a secret society that antedated the Masons, although they all fit in together because, of course, they're all really founded in the Gnostic faith. So you pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, I wanted to make one more point about the pentagram, and that is the final potential theory is that the unfinished pentagram in D.C. relates to the planet Venus, because Venus is a huge, Venus is a symbol for the Virgin, and of course David Ovison in his book goes on and on and on about how the symbolism of the Virgin is so prevalent in Washington, D.C., and there's a star pattern, like a triangle of stars that supposedly symbolize Virgo. And then there's a lot of Virgin symbolism throughout the city itself. But the pattern that Venus forms around the sun was known by ancient astrologers.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening. Chris Pinto, Anomalous Films?
Adullam Films.
Okay, fine. Adullam Films. Chris, would you like to get your website out so people would know how they could get some of your information?
Oh, sure. It's adullamfilms.org. That's A-D-U-L-L-A-M Films, F-I-L-M-S, .org. Or you can go to filmforjesus.com. If you can't remember Adullam Films. But Adullam is the cave Adullam from 1 Samuel chapter 22, where David fled when he was being persecuted by King Saul. Anyway, so adullamfilms.org is our main site, or filmforjesus.com. It takes you to the same place.
And Chris has done a wonderful job with this series. He's done other Christian films, which we do carry. But of course, my favorite is this trilogy. And that is, of course, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone, and the latest edition is The Eye of the Phoenix, which goes into the symbology on the back of the dollar bill. But let's stay with the story of what you're going to see in Washington, D.C., because suddenly there are all sorts of references to the ancient Greek gods, aren't there? In fact, isn't it a lot of the architecture there definitely related to Greek architecture?
Yeah, it's a combination of Greco, Roman, Egypt, you know, a little bit of Egyptian with a Washington Monument, and then some Babylonian-styled reliefs, but the Greco-Roman is probably the most dominant. I mean, you've got, you know, that you don't normally see in pictures. You've got Medusa heads with snakes coming out all over the place. You've got these very, you've got satyrs. That are at least one satyr inside the Library of Congress. You've got a number of them that, you know, look like little demons blowing their horns. You've got a very Rosicrucian image of a crucifixion inside the Library of Congress, with a double-headed black-winged phoenix behind an image of a crucifixion scene. And it says, there's a Latin phrase in there that says, "In the shadow of thy wings, O Lord," and so on, which was one of the phrases often used by Rosicrucians. But it's a very occult-looking representation of the crucifixion mingled in with, as you said, zodiacs everywhere. The zodiac is probably the most dominant feature in Washington, D.C., because they use it over and over and over again. And symbolically, it's also another symbol for this idea of ascending into perfection. In fact, in the Library of Congress, they have all of these sayings and phrases written on the wall. And once you understand their code, they begin to make more sense. But one of the more obvious ones says, "The true Shekinah is man." Okay? And, of course, Shekinah for Christians, we know that the Shekinah glory of God, the glory of God that's shown in the temple when Solomon finished the temple in Jerusalem. And what it reads in the Library of Congress is the true Shekinah, the true glory of God, is man. And it's really pointing toward the idea, the occult Gnostic concept, that man is his own God. And so, and that's really the recurring theme throughout Washington, D.C. They repeat the idea of the Pythagorean triangle in a variety of different ways. If you're standing in front of certain buildings, you'll see a triangle configuration. There'll be a male figure on one side, a female figure on the other side, and then up above, at kind of the peak or the top of the triangle, will be a symbol of some perfected ideal, whether it's, you know, liberty or justice or industry, and so on, that all of these are, you know, perfected concepts that we should aspire to as a society. But it's all based on their hermetic symbolism. That's what your reflecting pools in Washington, D.C. are all about. If you go online and you look up the Washington Monument, look for the nighttime view, and we show images of all this in the film, but if you look for a nighttime view of the Washington Monument, you'll see the Washington Monument going upward, okay, and then the reflecting pool, there's this long reflecting pool that comes down in front of it, and then you see the same monument down below it. And what they're doing is they're mimicking an ancient Rosicrucian arcane image that's published by Eliphas Levi and all these other occultists, where you have an image of a man who's sitting upward and he's staring down at a pool of water, and his image is down below in the pool of water and it's up above, and again it's that hermetic maxim, as above so below, and it's alluding to their concept again, that the path to godhood for man is to get in touch with his higher self, which is in the stars. That's what all the zodiacs and the star symbolism is about. And if he can be empowered by the stars, he himself, by his own efforts, can ascend into perfection. And so, so that's, you know, yet another representation of that symbolism.
And of course, that was the lie that was told in the Garden of Eden. That you can be as God, that you can be as God. And that has always certainly been the temptation. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we really could be God? I remember Shirley MacLaine in the motion picture that was shown on television, standing on the beach and shouting, "I am God, I am God, I am God." Well, I got news for you. You're not God, and that's the message of The Secret of Rhonda Byrne's a little book and a DVD that sold, I think, about 7 million copies of the book and many million copies of the DVD, featured a number of times on Oprah Winfrey. And as you get into The Secret, there is a secret, there is power there, but ultimately you're told in the book, the secret is you are God. You have the power, and you can claim the power, and you can have whatever you want to. And the trouble is that some people have claimed the power, and they've gotten great wealth and great fortune, but at a terrible, terrible price, as far as eternity is concerned. We certainly, as Chris shows you what's really there in Washington, D.C., one of the things that was a little surprising was that a picture or was that a statue of Francis Bacon? Most Americans have no idea the importance of Francis Bacon as far as America was concerned after he died in, I think, 1628. And yet, of course, he was the man who had written a book called The New Atlantis, the theme being that America would become the New Atlantis and lead the world back, of course, to the wonderful glory that existed at the time when before Atlantis was destroyed. Would you like to pick up on that thought? Because I think it's so vitally important to understanding what is going on today, and of course this move towards the one world government that America is on the verge of creating.
Yeah, I mean, there are whole societies, even to this day, that insist that the real and true founder of America is Sir Francis Bacon. And of course, in part one of the series, in New Atlantis, we talk about Bacon's book and how his book was an allegory that's really showing an outline for what he envisioned the New World to be. And of course, when the New World was discovered, he believed that man had discovered the site, the literal site of ancient Atlantis, and that it was destined to be, you know, from that site, from where you and I are right now, was destined to be launched this New Atlantis that would eventually, you know, prosper, succeed, and so on, through scientific achievement, something that Bacon wrote about extensively. I mean, he's writing here in the 1600s about a society where they have flying machines and tall buildings and submarines and weapons of mass destruction, and they've got centers of science where they conduct experiments on animals, injecting them with poisons, so that they can find cures for human beings. I mean, some of the stuff that he's writing about in his book is very, very detailed, and we see, of course, come to pass in America in the 19th and 20th centuries. And this is the reason why so many people believe that Bacon was so very influential. And if you study Bacon in terms of his writing, his literature, his printing, and his scientific endeavors, and then you begin to study men like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, you find a lot of parallels. And both of those men, you know, revered Francis Bacon. In fact, there's some reports that Jefferson believed he was fulfilling Bacon's dream of a new Atlantis through the establishment of the United States. And this is even talked about even further by Charles A.L. Totten in the 19th century, who wrote the first history of the symbols on the dollar bill, which we discuss in Eye of the Phoenix. And again, he's writing about how America was the founding of this new Atlantean dream. And it becomes very compelling for us as Christians, as believers, when you're looking back through history and there's all these debates about who among the founders was or was not a Christian. If you study Bacon, you begin to understand Rosicrucianism, because Rosicrucianism is the mingling of Christianity and paganism. And if you read The New Atlantis, Bacon thinks nothing of, you know, referring to Christian sailors who revere the Lord Jesus Christ and his sacrifice on the cross, and stuff like this, you know, a lot of very Christian-sounding dialogue. But then he's mingling his writing with all of these pagan concepts, with, you know, Apollo and Athena, and calling upon these gods, these muses, to inspire him with secret knowledge. And, of course, Bacon was a disciple of Dr. John Dee. John Dee was deeply involved in witchcraft and the occult, and I mean openly involved in summoning demonic spirits to give him secret knowledge and so on. And Dee had been the head of the Rosicrucians, and then he handed off the leadership then to Bacon. And then Bacon took it to a whole new level and is today considered not only, you know, really kind of the great guru for Rosicrucianism, but also the first Grand Master of modern masonry. Because many people don't realize, modern masons refuse to admit it, but the inner secrets of Masonry are really based in Rosicrucianism. Of course, we talk about all of that in the film, and we had an opportunity to interview the leading expert in the world on Bacon, a guy named Peter Dawkins over in England. And here's somebody with links to the royal family there in England, and to the pro-grand master of all British Freemasonry, who is arguably the most powerful Mason in the world. And he has control over a place called Canonbury Tower there, which Sir Francis Bacon lived in and had his invisible secret society meetings, centuries ago. His name is the Marquis de Northampton. But anyway, but we take you to all those places in part one in the series. But really the fruition of all of that, and I think the proof of it, this is where Riddles and Stone is so important. You have to ask yourself a question if you're a Christian. Did Christian men fight a Christian revolution and then in celebration of their Christian victory erect all of these buildings and monuments to pagan gods and goddesses that God condemns throughout the Bible? Is that what happened? God inspired these men to build obelisks and images of Medusa heads with serpents and, God and goddess figures everywhere. When in the Bible God is referring to these things as demonic powers, Paul says, I tell you that the sacrifice which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And he says, I would not that you have fellowship with demons. He says, you cannot drink from the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot eat bread from the table of the Lord and the table of demons, lest we provoke God to anger. So I believe the architecture of Washington, D.C. stands as the clearest proof that many of these men who were in positions of leadership were doing exactly what Manly Hall says they were doing in his book, America's Secret, or The Secret Destiny of America. And that is, he says, the pagan intellectuals reclothed their original ideas in a garment of Christian phraseology, but they bestowed their inner secrets only upon those who had been initiated into these secret societies. And that's what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. We're seeing the open display of their inner secrets.
And, of course, the average Christian, and I'm sure that the time when the Washington, D.C. was built, the average Christian could not see this. They did not understand this. They had not been taught, by their ministers about these occult forces which were here. It's always been hidden, as they hid the emblem which we see on the back of the dollar bill today, the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye, but that was put on the back of the Great Seal of the United States, not really to be seen or understood until it was put on the back of the dollar bill in 1935 by Franklin Roosevelt. But everything had to be hidden because, of course, the last thing they wanted was for the average American who was, founded in Christianity to realize that the occultists were here. There were secret societies here. There were always sort of little inklings of this. My grandfather told my father about 100 years ago that there was a secret society that was running our country. He called it the Illuminati at that time. And my dad, after I got involved, told me, but this might have been maybe 30 or 40 years ago, what his father had told him. But most people really found it very difficult to believe that these forces were here, and yet they have been here since the very beginning. And, of course, we're seeing this manifested today as our country has been taken over, is involved in torture, is involved in aggressive wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's always an excuse for it, but one reason, of course, they had to, of course, to take out Iraq was Saddam Hussein didn't want to go around with the world government. He wanted to run his own country. Now, he was an evil and wicked man, but there's so many of the Muslim countries that will not want to go along with this idea of the world government. But, of course, this is why I fear that we're moving into a war with the Muslim world, and we will destroy anyone who doesn't want to go along with the New World Order, the New World Financial System, the New World Currency, and, of course, the New World Religion. Well, I guess it's been Chris Pinto. His wonderful, wonderful films. The first of all, the Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. There's a trilogy. The second, Riddles in Stone, which we've been talking about tonight. The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And the third, The Eye of the Phoenix. It's the latest one. And, of course, I really enjoyed that one. I think I hope our listeners will want to get this if they're available from Radio Liberty. Chris has done a wonderful job, and he's actually beginning to work on the fourth film of the series. We can thank Chris, and we can thank David Bay of Cutting Edge Ministry for really putting this together. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, Chris, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh. Healthy. Easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Eye of the Phoenix, going into the secret symbology on the back of the dollar bill. They do an excellent job. In each one of the films, you get all three of them together at a special reduced rate, or you can get them individually. But get them and watch them, and watch them several times, because we have to depend upon you to have the information and to be able to, of course, get other people to understand what's really going on. And, of course, funds from this, of course, go back to David Bay, who has actually funded the first three films, and hopefully we can have a number more in this series. Actually, as soon as these came out, why, History Channel and Discovery Channel started putting on films to counter that, because the last thing they want is for the American people to learn the truth, because working at the highest level of the media in America are these same occult and sinister forces that have wanted to conceal the truth about the secret societies that not only have operated in the past, but are operating in the present time, and using the financial and military power of the United States to bring about this world government. Well, certainly we hope that many of you also will want to get a new DVD we have. It's called The Shack. Now, The Shack is the new book. It's the most popular Christian book of our era. Some people have compared it with Paul Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And, of course, it's being recommended in many of our churches. Bible studies are being held upon this. People are buying cases of the book to give to their friends. Somebody even sent me, very close to me, had sent me a copy of The Shack for Christmas. This is a heretical book. And, of course, Eric Barger has done a wonderful job of putting together a DVD on The Shack. And we recommend it. It's called The Death of Discernment. The Death of Discernment, and we hope that you'll want to get that. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you can get the trilogy or any one of the three the DVDs that Chris Pinto has put out so far. And then, of course, I want to mention our new DVD. It's called Financial Armageddon. It will explain to you how they produced the current financial problem, why they produced the current financial problem, and, of course, that it goes a little into the background of President Obama. Who or what was the force behind his ascendancy into the presidency? And this is now what I say. It's what they say. The information you're never going to read in Time Magazine or Newsweek or U.S. News and World Report, because they're part of the problem. And they all tie into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. But if you're going to get something now that's new and you want to understand what's going on financially, Financial Armageddon, the DVD, the syllabus, or get them both together, reduce costs. We think it's so vitally important that people understand and then can explain to others why things are happening and what lies ahead. And do not believe that what you're reading in the newspapers or hearing on CNBC or the other outlets, because, of course, your mind is being controlled, your tastes are being formed, your ideas are being created by men you will never heard of. You'll have no idea who they are, but you're being manipulated. Most people are being manipulated, and most people are going to lose everything they have before this is over. And this is going to make us all increasingly reliant upon our Lord. So, again, if you'd like to get the items we've talked about, the Death of Discernment, the Story of the Shack, the Trilogy, and then, of course, my new DVD, The Financial Armageddon. Again, the number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Don't forget about the Conspiracy Conference next weekend. And we'll be there. Hope you will be, too. And then, of course, please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly working full-time, writing his blog, certainly writing books, doing radio programs, and we feel it privileged to have William with us this evening as we begin to look about what is going on in the world today. And, of course, William was with us earlier, and we had a wonderful discussion. What are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about the same thing or something different, William?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to talk a little bit about this year's version or this year's installment of the perennial crisis with North Korea. But as sort of a preface to that, I think it's worthwhile to point out that just in the last couple of days, I think it was yesterday, there was this forum in Toronto featuring former presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. This is a sort of an engagement that's held, I think it's sponsored by a quasi-establishmentarian group up in Canada that's broadly comparable, if you will, to the Council on Foreign Relations down here in the United States. Every English-speaking country has got the equivalent of a Council on Foreign Relations. As you point out in your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, they're all offspring of the Anglo-American network that was created by the underground quasi-secret society that Cecil Rhodes and company created. But they had this forum up in Toronto yesterday, and you had Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, who, according to their partisan supporters and their partisan detractors, were supposedly poles apart on everything, completely incompatible with each other in terms of politics, personality, and values. And yet you have George W. Bush referring to Bill Clinton as, quote, his brother. And the reason why he said this is because Bill Clinton has sort of been taken into the bosom of the Bush family by George Bush the Elder and George Bush's wife. And that is to say, the former first couple of in the first Bush administration from 89 to 93, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton have been almost inseparable over the last several years. And it's just really interesting to see how, in terms of the body language and in terms of the deference that Bill Clinton gives, he really seems to regard George Bush the Elder as not only a father figure, and bear in mind, of course, that Mr. Clinton's life before he became a politician was sort of barren of legitimate father figures to begin with, but also as sort of his senior in the political hierarchy or in what passes for sort of the nobility of the American political structure. There really is this sense that this one-term president who seems to be sort of a peripheral footnote in politics is a really weighty and consequential figure. And if you understand anything about how these quasi-secretive groups are organized, you'd understand that George Bush the Elder is a real heavyweight in that universe. But it's just interesting to see George W. Bush refer to Bill Clinton as his brother and recognize that they're all part of the same fraternity, if you will.
Well, you know, it was in 2003 when the Bush Family Foundation actually gave an award to the most outstanding American citizen at the, of that year, a man named Senator Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
I mean, this is so unbelievable that the American people would really believe there's a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. It's all symbolism over substance, rhetoric over reality. But, of course, the suckers believe it year after year after year. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, I do think that's a really good way of putting it. The fact that you're dealing here with an almost perfectly fungible set of variables here, personalities, and the way that the political structure is worked, there's not even if you take inflation into consideration, there's not the proverbial dime's worth of difference here. They play to different constituencies, and they use different hot-button issues to mobilize their followers and keep them on the reservation. There's always this dread that if the other side is permitted to win, something terrible will happen, and we'll lose some great aspirational accomplishment. For instance, with respect to the Republican Party, we're always told that we have to be in perfect terror of a Democratic president, rather, because they'll appoint pro-abortion judges to the bench, when, of course, if we take a look at the Republican record on that particular issue, the Roe v. Wade decision was written by a Republican appointee, and most of the judges that have upheld the unconstitutional framework that Roe imposed upon our country are Republicans or Republican appointees. There really is no substantive difference there, but we're always told that we're at the brink of victory, or we've got momentum behind us, and we have to prevent the other side from achieving some key victory, when it always seems as if this is an exercise as futile as trying to overtake our horizon. Well, of course it is, because people are kept on the reservation with this sense of aspirational accomplishment. And aspirational, of course, means that it's not tangible, it's not really a practical thing. But the thing that I wanted to talk about here, specifically with reference to the seamlessness between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, one very exemplary example is the subject of North Korea. Back in 1994, about this time of year in 1994, it seems that we almost always have some perennial crisis with North Korea, sometime in the early summer or late spring. I don't know why that is. I'm not really privy to the timetable or the opaque maneuverings that result in this type of situation, but it seems as if in some period of time between March and June, we have some kind of a crisis with North Korea, and it usually involves the prospect of North Korea either acquiring a bomb, having some kind of a nuclear test, testing some kind of a missile, and of course over the last week we've had both. We've had a nuclear test for North Korea, which we already knew was a nuclear power, incidentally, and we've also had the North Korea test a new short-range missile. This has not really changed the strategic circumstances at all, but yet we're hearing now that we're in a new and more dangerous phase of relations with North Korea, and the prospect of war on the peninsula now is becoming a more vivid reality. And, of course, it's all the most perfect nonsense. It's all something that has been ginned up for public consumption for reasons of PR, and quite frankly, because this is something that has been going on for
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William was saying that we've had these crises with North Korea for many years. Usually, to refer to 1994, it was in the late spring or early summer that we had a crisis with North Korea. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, these are all stage managed. You have to have an enemy. You have to convince the American people there's an enemy out there, there's a boogeyman, and if we don't support the administration, the boogeyman's going to get us. In fact, I was watching this evening's television, and we saw the pictures of the missiles, you know. They sort of looked like they were missiles. I don't know what they were. They could have been just round tubes of steel, but we're told those are deadly missiles that can be launched, and, they have intermediate and long-range missiles. They have nuclear weapons, and I can remember, 40 years ago, seeing those same pictures, only they were in Red Square. Oh, the communists were our enemy. Of course, at those days, I didn't understand that all the Russian technology, Russian finance, it was all coming from America in an organized, orchestrated effort to create the best enemy that money could buy. But now that the Russians are our friends and the Chinese are our friends, now, of course, we have North Korea, and we know, of course, how irresponsible they are. So please go ahead, William.
Yeah, and that's not, of course, to say that North Korea's ruling elite under President Kim Jong-il is anything other than horrific. I mean, Kim Jong-il is quite possibly psychotic. We don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if he were. He's living in a totalitarian bubble, whereas the dear leader, he's treated as a deity on Earth. And, of course, that type of deference, receiving that type of deference, is never a healthy thing. The type of people who would seek that kind of adulation from their followers have got to be somewhat deranged to begin with. I mean, megalomania, I believe, is a therapeutic condition. So I don't think that there's any reason to think that he's anything other than a deranged madman, but he's not suicidal. He does sit at the top of a pyramid of totalitarian power, and he does preside over a society that's like an anthill. People have no privacy, they have no freedom of action, they have no right to own property in any realistic sense, they have no control over their own destiny. The principle of self-ownership is not recognized in the communitarian or collectivist society or a totalitarian communist society like North Korea. So while we dismiss the, well, I, and I know that you agree with me, Dr. Stan, dismiss North Korea as a real tangible threat to the United States, to our security, and to our well-being, it's not because the North Korean government and the regime that it imposes upon North Koreans is not a menace to that population. It certainly is. It's just not an aggressive menace, a credible aggressive menace to the United States, and I really believe that it isn't really a menace to South Korea or Japan. It can inflict damage. It can do nasty things. For many decades, North Korea's intelligence agency has been abducting Japanese citizens and holding them for ransom. For a number of decades, North Korea's Secret Service has been manufacturing super notes, which are counterfeit $100 bills, and using them to finance all kinds of mischief, including drug trafficking.
But, of course, the most amazing thing about that is, William, you know, that is an act of war to counterfeit somebody else's currency, and yet we've allowed them to do it.
Yeah.
We have never tried to stop them from doing it, and by not trying to stop them or telling them they either stop that or we're going to quit giving them rice and food and oil and building nuclear power plants for them and keeping their structure of the government intact, we would just say, you will stop counterfeiting our money. By not doing that, we have actually and actively financed this terrible and tyrannical country. And there's not one person in 1,000 in America who really understands they've been counterfeiting our money and we've been letting them do it.
Well, I think that when you look at it with a cynical eye, and of course I have two cynical eyes with which I examine all political developments, I think that the super notes issue is a really good example of a uniquely economical foreign aid program. You know, rather than putting us through the trouble of having the Federal Reserve counterfeit money to send to North Korea, we allow North Korea to subcontract that function and counterfeit its own money and put it into circulation. It's probably just as plausible, certainly just as valuable as the counterfeit money that the Federal Reserve officially disseminates on behalf of the regime. So it seems to me that this is a good example of North Korea simply cutting out the middleman and going to counterfeiting for its own. That's the same kind of thing that's happened in some ways with respect to other types of foreign aid programs in history where the federal government has permitted a putatively hostile regime, one with which we're supposedly at the brink of war, to do certain things almost as if they're extending a type of license to the enemy in order to do something that saves Washington the problem of actually appropriating money through Congress in order to accomplish an objective. But you talk about the aid program that's been going on. This is something that grew out of that crisis from 1994, this aid program to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. It's just really remarkable. Earlier today, I reflected with you, Dr. Stan, about the fact that in 1994, there was this week-long frenzy over the prospect of North Korea acquiring nuclear weapons. And it really grew to such a fever pitch that on one particular episode of the old CNN program Crossfire, you had the founder of the Trilateral Commission, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Lawrence Eagleburger, who was a heavyweight in every conceivable sense of the expression, with the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, both sitting on Crossfire as the two experts, talking in unison about the idea that if necessary we would strike North Korea with nuclear weapons by way of preempting their ability to acquire a nuclear weapon. And within a week, we had the framework for an agreement with Pyongyang, whereby the United States was going to provide them with, among other things, light water nuclear reactors and heating oil. You mentioned food, of course, huge supplies of rice to deal with the government-created famine in North Korea, and also huge increments of cash. This happened within a week. This was brokered by former President Jimmy Carter, who, taking advantage, or perhaps being sent, I suspect that he was sent by way of being an emissary of the power elite, to North Korea, taking advantage of this atmosphere of crisis, brokered this agreement with North Korea, where in exchange for supposed promises that they wouldn't pursue the development of a nuclear weapon, we were giving them nuclear reactors and all kinds of benefits. This persisted through the regime, the change of administration from the Clinton era to the Bush era. George W. Bush, in spite of the fact that he had famously described North Korea as part of an axis of evil, which is one of the more hackneyed expressions that's ever been mouthed by an American president, maintained this program where the United States was sending huge amounts of money and food aid and nuclear aid, of all the unlikely things, to North Korea in exchange for supposed promises that they would not be continuing their nuclear weapons program.
And it seemed obvious to any intelligent observer at the time that you don't deter a government, a so-called rogue government, from pursuing a nuclear weapons program by giving them nuclear reactors. It seemed very obvious that if you were giving them everything they want in exchange for anodyne promises that they would go back on what they'd already managed to develop successfully, that you were not going to have a successful outcome if the objective were to keep them from getting nuclear weapons. And lo and behold, of course, a couple of years ago, it was revealed and fairly well documented that Pyongyang had managed to develop the capacity to build a nuclear weapon with the help of A.Q. Khan, who was somebody who was sort of the Typhoid Mary or the Johnny Appleseed, depending upon your preferred metaphor, of nuclear proliferation, somebody who was receiving aid from many people in the American establishment, by the way, in seeding the unstable areas of the world with the knowledge of how to build nuclear weapons, key secrets in that process, that North Korea had developed the capacity to build a nuclear weapon. It really wasn't a surprise to find that out, but lo and behold, there it was. And now this year, there's been this fit of temporary and convenient amnesia in the interim, and now we're once again being told that we have to be at a fever pitch of concern over the fact that North Korea, we just recently discovered, is a nuclear power. Well, we didn't just recently discover that. Nothing's really changed. It's still the same regime. It's still the same hermetic, insular, unsustainable totalitarian model that's being propped up by Washington, D.C., for reasons of cynical manipulation of public opinion on both sides of the barrier, on both sides of the 38th parallel, inside the Hermit Kingdom and outside the Hermit Kingdom, by stationing people there at the DMZ. And we have a huge and incredibly well-equipped military presence in South Korea. We are helping official propagandists in the North to maintain the state of siege upon which Kim's regime depends. And at the same time, by playing to fears in this country about the prospect of nuclear terrorism, we're seeing people being programmed in a marginal and peripheral way, but in an important way, I believe, being programmed to think that we have to be willing to support the government's interventionist foreign policy and multilateral diplomacy, and these are the instruments that are being used to create the problem that is in turn being used to create a mindset receptive to a continuation of this insane foreign policy. If we were dealing with a rational and genuinely patriotic set of people in the corridors of power in Washington, what they would do would be to recognize that we don't have any fundamental interests in the Korean Peninsula. We don't have any reason to station soldiers at the 38th parallel, who are there basically to be a tripwire anyway. In the event that North Korea wanted to launch a blitzkrieg, we would take heavy losses for 4 or 5 days. Assuming the conflict remained conventional, it would take about a week in order to reverse that situation. And within a couple of weeks, I honestly believe North Korea would be completely helpless. You just don't sustain a first-class military with a totalitarian economy. It just doesn't work that way. But we don't have any reason to have that military force in South Korea that would be defensible in terms of American interests, and we don't have any reason to keep them there if our objective is to see Korea unified on terms favorable to freedom. What we should do is pull the troops out and encourage the undermining of the North Korean regime by the South Korean government, which can provide a better example of a model that can work on that peninsula.
But it almost seems as if, well, we need an enemy. You have to have an enemy to rally the American people behind our government. And now, of course, President Obama is taking a courageous stand against this renegade country that we've been keeping in power all these years. But the average American is never told that. Oh, my goodness, look at those missiles. Why, any time one of them could come raining down on the West Coast, or who knows. We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead, William.
Well, Dr. Stanley made reference to the fact that Barack Obama now is being portrayed as a flinty-eyed, steel-spined realist in political affairs because it's his turn to face down the eccentric dictator of Pyongyang. And I really believe that that's one reason they cultivate enemies of this sort, is to provide dramatic, or melodramatic, would be a better word, melodramatic foils for these insipid little dramas that they write, melodramas that they write in international affairs. They always have to find somebody who can be a theatrical, a suitably cinematic antagonist for the President of the United States, because that's part of the founding myth and the enduring sacral myth of the presidency, is that the presidency is the leader of the quote-unquote free world, and that he has to be invested with these quasi-dictatorial powers in order to protect the United States from the Bane influence of the dictators that exist throughout the world and in obscure places that are not really of immediate importance or terribly familiar to most Americans. You remember that Ambrose Bierce once said that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography, and that's supposed to be a slap in the face for the insularity of Americans. There are certainly better ways to learn geography. We could be conducting commerce with these countries and with these kingdoms throughout the world. Before we had an interventionist foreign policy, as a matter of fact, that was the policy of the United States government. We had a Navy that had as its mission the protection of the commercial use of the shipping lanes in order to maintain commerce with pretty much every part of the world, every part of the globe. It's not isolationist to say that we shouldn't be involved militarily and politically in the affairs of other countries. What we're saying is that we should be involved in ways that actually promote the growth of free markets, and we should evangelize on behalf of individual freedom by practicing its virtues rather than practicing militarism. But there's this idea that a president's not really a president unless he's somehow involved in some kind of hostile face-off with some country or the other, and that a president doesn't genuinely become a chief executive until he's bloodied his hands by ordering a military strike. I really don't think that in the last 40 or 50 years, with the possible exception of Ronald Reagan, ironically enough, that we've had a president who's been inaugurated without actually being involved within the very first couple of days in some kind of military strike somewhere, usually involving an order to launch a missile or to carry out an airstrike, or in the case of Barack Obama, to send drones over Pakistan, remote-controlled drones that wiped out, in a couple of occasions, dozens or scores of civilians. I know that early in Ronald Reagan's presidency, I believe, was April or May of 1981, there was an incident over the Gulf of Sirte off of the coast of Libya, where a couple of American fighter jets were targeted by Libyan MiGs, and they took defensive action, which meant that there were a couple of MiGs that ended up at the bottom of the Gulf of Sirte. And that was the only thing I can think of that would be a rough equivalent of this, but just about everybody else within a very brief period of time of becoming president has gotten involved somewhere in some kind of military activity. It's almost as if they have to baptize that presidency in blood in order for it to be a real presidency. And that's part of the nature of the presidency, that is a legacy of a number of really terrible events and a number of very lamentable developments.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and go right ahead, William. You were just talking about, of course, the fact that Ronald Reagan, at least initially, was not, damned with the military crisis, but of course later on he did have a number of crises. The Iran-Contra scandal was one of the biggest ones, and of course it was during his administration that so many terrible things happened that actually were forerunners of where we are today. But
that's true.
At least initially he did quite well. Go right ahead.
Yeah, we had the fortuitous, and some cynics think orchestrated, release the hostages the same day that he was inaugurated. There are people who believe that there was duplicitous diplomacy going on before the election of Ronald Reagan, that it resulted in a secret deal that freed the hostages the day of his inauguration. I'm agnostic on that front. I don't know whether or not to believe that that's the case, but I do know that it was fortuitous that you didn't have a situation where, as just today in the headlines we read about, there was actually an acting order on Ronald Reagan's desk to bomb Tehran if there were harm to the hostages. That might have had something to do with the fact that hostages were released, but in any case, it wasn't until May of that year that we actually had a military encounter, and it was a military encounter in which you had the defensive use of of anti-aircraft missiles by American F-16s against Libyan MiGs. But as you point out, Dr. Sten, there were other things that happened in the Reagan administration that sort of foreshadowed some of the things that are going on right now. It was during the Reagan administration that we saw the militarization of the war on drugs. That, I think, is perhaps the most significant legacy of the Reagan administration in terms of domestic politics. We also had, of course, the aid to the Mujahideen and the so-called Nicaraguan Contras, which were part of the other half of the war on drugs, because both the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and some elements, not all, but some elements of the Contras, were involved in drug trafficking as a way of raising revenue, and some of those drugs ended up on the streets of American cities, and that fueled the war on drugs. They created the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory, as Bastier would say. And we had, of course, the long-standing legacy of those elements of the Mujahideen that were armed by the CIA, coalescing into, among other things, the Al-Qaeda movement. And Mr. bin Laden was involved in some elements of that effort. And so this, once again, is a long-standing legacy, unfortunately, of the Reagan administration. But this idea of the president being the commander-in-chief, that's usually how the president is referred to now. That's a function of the office. That's not really the nature of the office. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States when they are called into the service of the United States by Congress. It's a limited, specific function that is subject to congressional oversight. Congress still has the power of the purse. Congress still has the sole power to declare war. Congress still has the sole power to establish regulations for the government and the military. But the commander-in-chief, that is to say the highest official in the chain of command, is the civilian who occupies the Oval Office, and that was done in order to have civilian control of the military. But there's this idea that somehow the President of the United States is a figure which transcends the powers of his office, and that until his hands have become bloody somehow in some kind of a foreign conflict, he's not a real president. And this is part of the myth of the president that's really taken root and flourished from Lincoln through Woodrow Wilson and FDR, and then Harry Truman in particular. And the Korean War was very much a part of this transmogrification of the executive branch into sort of a short-term elected dictatorship. Harry Truman committed the United States to the war in Korea without a declaration of war by Congress. He didn't even ask for one. What he said is that by virtue of the fact that Congress had approved the NATO Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is an article, I believe Article 7, Chapter 51, regional subset, regional affiliate of the United Nations, because the NATO Treaty had been approved by Congress, and the President had the power through the NATO Treaty to station troops in Europe on his own, of his own volition, on his own accord, that the President could use that same power to send troops anywhere in the world, including North Korea, or forgive me, including Korea, to fight this conflict. And so he sent the troops on his own supposed authority, derivative of the NATO agreement, and they fought under the command of the United Nations. They were under the functional, the strategic, and the tactical operational control of the United Nations. Now, General Douglas MacArthur and then General Mark Clark were the American leaders of the coalition assembled by the United Nations to fight Korea. But the General Military Staff Committee of the United Nations was headed by a Soviet national who relayed all of the war plans of the coalition into the hands of the Chinese and the North Koreans. The fix was in. There was never going to be a victory. Yet thousands of Americans, tens of thousands, die for a tie in Korea, and that armistice persists to this day.
And, of course, it was the same thing in Vietnam. It was another no-win war. We were never allowed to win the war, and we could have won it at any time. I personally talked to Ambassador William H. Sullivan and to General Lewis Wald, a four-star Marine general. Both of them told me we could win the war in 2 months if we could have just been allowed to attack North Vietnam. They would not allow us to try to win the war. We were just to send our boys over to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but never win. It was Korea all over again, and we're involved in a similar situation in Afghanistan.
The prairie, to the old.
Well, William, you go right ahead.
You know, before we leave entirely the subject of Ronald Reagan's presidency, I think I should give him credit for one thing, and it's partial credit. That's the fact that after he allowed himself to be talked into sending American troops to Lebanon as part of a UN peacekeeping force in 1982, and of course that was a perfectly horrible decision. We had no business getting involved in that multi-partite cluster, this immense and multi-sided mess of a conflict in which really there was no party that represented anything that we would consider to be a freedom-oriented movement. We had no business getting involved in that mess. But after Ronald Reagan got talked into sending troops to Lebanon under UN mandate as peacekeepers, and we had the horrible disaster in 1983 of the Marine barracks being bombed, and what a debacle that was, where they chose a barracks at the bottom of a rise where they had the low ground, and you had Marine guards stationed out supposedly to provide security, who didn't even have ammunition in their weapons. They had these people clustered in one area where they were a very convenient target at the bottom of a rise where you had the enemy have the high ground. You didn't have sentries who were even armed. They were just begging for these Marines to be killed. 241 of them lost their lives. But after that, and after a number of other obvious setbacks, Reagan defied the prevailing wisdom by pulling out of Lebanon, by not reinforcing failure when it would have been potentially disastrous for the United States to stay. He had the clarity of mind to realize that at a certain point, it really makes no sense to be throwing lives away, irreplaceable human lives.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Sten. We were just talking about, of course, the fact that Ronald Reagan, after we had the attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983, that Ronald Reagan had the foresight to say, we're just going to pull our troops out.
Yep.
We're not going to stay here. We're not going to bring in more troops, you know, because we had this happen. Of course, what very few people know is what's written in Robert Baer's book, entitled See No Evil, and of course the whole theme of that book is, well, who was really behind what happened in Lebanon, the attack on the embassy, American embassy in Lebanon, the attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon, and both in 1983. And, of course, what he found was the CIA knew ahead of time the attacks were coming on the embassy. They knew the attack was coming on the Marine barracks. They knew it was done by Hezbollah, and we did nothing to stop it or to punish Hezbollah after that. And that really doesn't make sense. Whether Ronald Reagan ever knew that or not, I don't know. But it's a very important part of history that you're not going to hear elsewhere. The book, See No Evil by Robert Baer, available from Radio Liberty. But before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site. And do you have that donate button up there yet?
I'm still working on that. I'm trying to work it out to where we've got the PayPal account set up in a way that I'd consider suitable. I've talked with a number of people that have had problems with PayPal. I just want to make sure that we don't. I want to anticipate and preempt those problems. But that having been said, to read my blog, Pro Libertate, the easiest way to get to it is go to willgrigg.com and then look at the right-hand side of the screen at the list of outside links. And the list of external hyperlinks includes a link to the Pro Libertate website. I try to update that between 3 and 5 times a week. And so if you go to willgrigg.com and you hit that hyperlink, it'll take you right to Pro Libertate. Another way to do it is to go to Google and then type in Pro Libertate. That's LIBERTATE, Pro Libertate. And my last name, Grigg, and it should be the first result that turns up. But we're trying to set up some way for people who are interested in donating to this media enterprise that I'm creating. I'm basically a one-man media enterprise at this point. I do write the blog. I write for LouRockwell.com. I also write for his blog site, in addition to publishing essays on his site. I'm contributing essays to the Campaign for Liberty, which is an outgrowth of the Ron Paul presidential campaign, a very worthwhile undertaking. I do radio programs with you, Dr. Stan, and a number of other people, and I'm trying to set up my own hour-long radio program, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that as soon as we have the plans set up and more tangibly situated. I do have a book entitled Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. That's the fifth book that I have published. That's the most recent one that came out about a year ago. There's nothing in it that's out of date. It doesn't yet address specifically the Obama administration, but if you read that book, you'll certainly see where the Obama administration is fortifying and expanding upon the examples of its predecessor with respect to assaults on the liberties protected by the Bill of Rights. So all these things are available. If you read my blog, read the Pro Libertate blog, the essays that are published there, they're between 1,200 and, say, 2,000 words. If you get to the end of an essay, there's a thumbnail of the book cover for Liberty and Eclipse, and right next to it is a hyperlink that you can click to go to Amazon and buy the book if you're interested. It's also available through Radio Liberty. That's the way that people can support what I do. And soon enough, as we get the kinks ironed out with PayPal, I will have a donation button that people can hit if they're interested in donating to help keep this enterprise going. I wanted to make an additional point with respect to Robert Baer and his experiences in the CIA. He was very active in working with a lot of the putatively pro-American elements over in the Middle East. And I remember that the first time I became aware of him was when he talked about the studied and cynical betrayal of the Iraqi resistance in 1995, how basically they found themselves cattle-penned and then cut off in the northern part of Iraq, and how there was ample and detailed advance warning of a military strike against the infrastructure of the Iraqi resistance. This is in 1995. This is 4 years after the end of the war. And you have the CIA-funded resistance. They were primarily Kurds, but there were also some Shiite elements in it because the government of Saddam Hussein was Sunni, a minority Sunni government dominating the Shiites through force and terror. And they were wiped out in July and August of 1995 in an armor assault that involved the death of tens of thousands of people. This took place at a time when Iraq was cut into three pieces, the way that Caesar divided Gaul. You had two no-fly zones that were patrolled by U.S. and British warplanes, supposedly authorized by a U.N. Security Council resolution. Not that I consider that to be a legitimate undertaking. I don't think that the Security Council is the apex decision-making body in the world. But they didn't even have the fig leaf of a Security Council resolution. They just had the two no-fly zones. One of them supposedly protected the northern part of the country of Iraq, and there's another one in the southern part. And you had this crippling embargo that was slapped on all kinds of foodstuffs and medical goods going into Iraq that, of course, fortified Saddam Hussein's position even further. He was given the luxury of being the man in charge of administering the scarce goods that were rationed out, and, of course, that fortifies the power of a dictator while eviscerating his subjects. While all this is going on, though, the CIA permitted the Kurdish and Shiite resistance to be wiped out in the northern part of Iraq. And the first person I saw who gave a really detailed account of that was Robert Baer. So he's somebody who really knows where a lot of the proverbial bodies are buried and knows who are the people with the bloody hands in the CIA who've been running things for the last several decades. But with respect to our disastrous foreign policy in that region of the world, Mr. Baer is the fellow who has the most encyclopedic knowledge of the subject. He's also a very capable dissector of the influence of the Saudis in all of this and how the establishment in Washington has been very accommodating of the Saudis, just as it's been very accommodating of the Israelis. It's interesting that the Saudis and the Israelis, who are mortal enemies theologically and I guess ethnologically as well, their lobbies in Washington have an almost perfect symbiotic relationship because they both want to keep the United States entangled in the region, just as our own power elite wants to keep the United States entangled in the region. And all these cynical interests work in harmony against the people of the United States, against the people of Israel, against the people who are ruled by the Saudi kingdom, the Saudi monarchy, and against the people in the entire region. I mean, there's this... this entente that exists. I believe that the phrase used by Arthur Conan Doyle after World War One, he described them as the highborn conspirators against the peace of the world when he talked about the power elite that helped to manipulate all these countries into that mutual murder-suicide exercise that was World War One. And you have the same mechanism, the same architecture in place today, where you have these highborn conspirators against peace and freedom who are managing to betray the interests of all decent people and all sides of all these conflicts. The same is true of what's going on in Korea. Once again, we have to get back to the Korean episode because, once again, we're due, because this is, I guess, late May, for another installment of the perennial scare alerts about the influence of Kim Jong-il and his ambition to hold the world hostage with a couple of pathetic retrograde nuclear weapons, while the United States and Russia and a couple of other countries in the world have large nuclear arsenals and the supposed right to make preemptive use of the nuclear weapons. We have to go back to talking about how we ended up in this mess, and I think that when you talk about the circumstances that prevailed in 1950, when North Korea invaded South Korea, a very clear green light was issued by Secretary of State Dean Acheson when he gave a speech before the outbreak of hostilities in Korea, where he said that South Korea was outside the defensive perimeter of the United States. Now, I find a direct corollary between that speech and a conversation that took place 40 years later, in I believe it was June or July of 1990, between Saddam Hussein and April Glaspie. April Glaspie being an emissary of the Bush administration and the State Department, in which April Glaspie said, when in response to an inquiry from Saddam Hussein about problems he was having with Kuwait, that we did not take a position on inter-Arab conflicts of that sort. It was the same kind of green light, albeit perhaps a more subtle one in the case of April Glaspie, that was given by Dean Acheson in 1950. It was basically saying, sick 'em. You go ahead and do what you need to do. If the tanks have to roll across an international border, or if you have to launch some kind of a military strike that's going to kill civilians in Seoul, then go ahead and do it, because really it's outside of our perimeter of interest. And once this happens, of course, then the hue and cry goes up about naked aggression, whether you're talking about in the Korean Peninsula or naked aggression by Saddam Hussein against Kuwait, and the war fever is ginned up and people are infected with it, and next thing you know, of course, you have Americans being loaded onto ships and planes and sent thousands of miles away without a declaration of war to fight and die on behalf of the United Nations. The result is an ambiguous non-victory in a protracted state of crisis that happened in Korea and happened in Iraq for over 50 years, almost 60 years now. The United States has been at war with North Korea. The war never ended. There was a ceasefire, but there's never been a permanent peace established. That's why we have people on hair trigger alert at the 38th parallel, looking grimly across that DMZ at people on hair trigger alert looking southward across the Korean equivalent of the DMZ. That's why we still have in Iraq, we've got the second installment of the Gulf War that began in 1991, and we're just being told over the last couple of days that we're probably going to have troops in Iraq for the next 10 years or longer.
My goodness, I thought that President Obama was going to pull those troops out of Iraq.
Well, yeah.
Didn't he promise the American people that? But, oh, these are going to be non-combat troops. I'm sure we're going to take away their rifles and their hand grenades and the means they have to defend themselves. They'll be non-combat troops. I feel so much better.
Exactly. They'll be left to defend themselves with sharp sticks and harsh language. You know, when they don't belong there at all, which is the whole point of this. But I think that it's also worth pointing out that same Dean Acheson, who really, when the history books, when legitimate history is written and widely disseminated and well understood by the American public, Dean Acheson is going to become one of the great demonic figures of America's descent into what we're dealing with right now, because he was so deeply involved in so many of these horrible decisions. He gave a speech in 1953 in which he talked about the fact that starting in 1946 with the congressional elections of that year, there was this decided turn by the American public against involvement in world affairs in an interventionist kind of way. We were reasserting our traditional non-interventionist character and disposition as a nation. It's not the same thing as being an isolationist. North Korea is an isolationist country. They're cut off from the world. We've never been that way. As I mentioned before, we've always been involved in commerce. That's the best kind of way that we can be involved. We've had people doing humanitarian work. We've had plenty of involvement with people through commercial relations. We've been involved in missionary work, which, of course, is a form of outreach. You know, there have been plenty of Christian missionary work, which has been done from the United States. That involves, of course, contact with people all around the world. We've never been isolationists in that respect. We've pursued a good, mutually beneficial commercial relations with all. We've been, we hopefully, in our best and most commendable periods of our national history, not been inclined to bestow favoritism upon any country. We've been trying to be even-handed. Not always been that way before 1917 or so, but that was the aspiration, and that was the performance in some instances. But in 1946, we decided we had had enough of the glories of our embryonic empire, and we were starting to turn away from multilateral institutions. The United Nations was born, of course, in 1945, and immediately people had problems with it. It put off the odor of communism, and suddenly there were investigations going on that showed that the whole system was full of communists. You had people, of course, like Martin Dies, the Democrat from Texas, who ran the House Committee on Un-American Activities, who took aside a junior senator from Wisconsin by the name of Joseph McCarthy and said, look, we need to look into the fact that the Truman administration is not permitting investigation of these people with government salaries and access to classified and sensitive government information who are working for the other side. Don't you think that's an issue we should be looking into? So suddenly people were following the admonition from the New Testament that we should be cleansing the inner vessel. We had the Reese Committee hearings looking into the influence of the tax-exempt foundations. People, in other words, were saying, look, why are we going abroad in search of monsters to destroy when there are really bad, corrupt things going on in our own government that represent compromises with foreign elements that are trying to undermine our constitutional system of government and eventually destroy our liberties? All this was coming to a head, and then in 1950, Dean Acheson said in his 1953 speech, the Korean War came along and saved us. What it did was it gave the public something to look at in terms of a foreign enemy. It redirected people's scrutiny from what was going on within our own system outward toward a conveniently distant enemy that was demonic in nature and which was worth cultivating for the purpose of keeping the attention of the public riveted on this distant threat rather than examining what was going on in our own country. And, of course, that same trick is going on right now with respect to the so-called war on terrorism. And the same trick is going on right now with respect to Kim Jong-il and his handful of nuclear bombs and his second or third grade level ballistic missiles. They need these foreign enemies not only because they're useful for rallying the public behind these drives for foreign war, and foreign war, as James Madison said, is the parent of armies, and armies beget debts and taxes, and these are the known instruments for making the many subject to the will of the few. But they're also very, very useful in terms of redirecting our focus from our own problems, our own shortcomings and flaws and frailties and failings and sins, and starting to look telescopically at the sins and failings of others. You know, we're always paying more attention to the beams that are in the eyes of people like Kim Jong-il, and we're not paying attention to the I-beam girders that are in the eyes of our own ruling elite. And so that's one of the reasons why we have these perennial scare festivals involving people like Kim Jong-il and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran, and heaven only knows who it'll be next. But these are tricks that people keep falling for. These are, once again, the little melodramas that are scripted for the benefit of the people who are ruling us and who every day are undermining our liberties, what few of them remain, who are making our kids debt slaves in perpetuity and destroying the foundations of what had been a Christian-inspired free republic.
I think it's a very, very excellent description of what's going on today. The only trouble is that it may very well that they're going to be going to precipitate some sort of a confrontation.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, of course, we are really, I think, at the sort of the end of a long, long period of planning, aim to bring about a new world order. And I believe that there's probably going to be a world catastrophe in the coming years, perhaps not much, much sooner, that it'll be ultimately used to bring about the new world order, the new world religion, and, of course, the destruction of Christianity. That's their goal. They'll never accomplish it, but that's their goal. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, I really appreciate, as always, the opportunity to have some time to talk with you about what's going on in the world. And I do agree with you that we're facing a unique and unsettling hinge point in history. We are in, unmistakably, the opening phase of what is going to be a world historic economic meltdown. People aren't really paying sufficient attention to it in terms of its importance in the news. But if you talk with people about their own circumstances, this is a crisis which really affects people and deeply affects them. It has tangible results and tangible impact upon what people can do. And things are only going to grow worse, and we're going to have the opportunity, and it's the type of opportunity that I frankly don't covet, to find out exactly what our country is made out of in terms of what our values really are as opposed to those things we profess to be our values. It's been said, I believe it was by Samuel Johnson, that no man is a hypocrite in his pleasures. And in the same sense, no man really is a hypocrite. No man can really be duplicitous about what he is in the midst of a soul-revealing crisis. And the same is true of nations. As the pretexts are peeled away and as the illusion, the luxuriant illusion of prosperity is dispelled, we're going to find out exactly what it is that is important to us. We'll find out whether we retain, in any significant sense, the ability to surmount material privations by resisting the temptation of collectivist solutions, which is to say, placing our freedom in escrow and allowing some figure, a quasi-messianic political figure, a total power, in exchange for the promise of material security. And we're going to have the opportunity very soon to find out if we retain that stamp of our forefathers who were of the type of metal that would lead people to resist that type of a transaction. Many, many societies have faltered and failed when they have been required to confront those options. We know what happened to Germany in the 1930s as a result of their experience with the type of meltdown that we're going to be facing pretty soon. So by all means, let's pray that God will give us the strength and give us the grace to be brave and stalwart in confronting these times. And also, those of us who cherish liberty are going to have to redouble our efforts to help people understand what's going on and why.
Well, at least we have a voice, and you articulate this philosophy so very, very well. God bless you. William, we'll look forward to having you with us again next week right here at Radio Liberty.
Thanks. God bless, Dr.
And you too. Bye-bye. Okay, and for you out there in the listening audience, I think it's a real privilege. I always look forward to our Friday evening program with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty really is primarily listener-supported. We're really dependent upon those of you who hear our programs to help us. And if you believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, cultural, financial battlefield, but it is primarily a spiritual battle, and you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Or if you'd like to go to our webpage at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. There on the lead page is a donate button, and you can press it and see what actually happens. Well, anyway, of course, we want to remind you that we do have certainly my new DVD. It's called Financial Armageddon. It's a two-and-a-half-hour talk. But, of course, we have a PowerPoint presentation that goes with that that will give you the background of what's going on today. And certainly we recommend this. It comes with a syllabus, give you information you won't be able to get elsewhere. We do carry the book we've talked about called See No Evil by Robert Baer, where Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent working in Kurdistan all during the 1990s, said he never met a Iraqi who didn't believe that the United States government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. Many of them actually believed Saddam Hussein was working for the CIA. He tells about how on two occasions the Iraqi generals tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And you know what? The American State Department wouldn't let them do it. The American State Department would let them do it. The book See No Evil. We also carry a book called The Devil's Game that goes into the how the United States CIA financed the Mujahideen, and then how they financed the Al-Qaeda and how they financed the Taliban. Fascinating look. In fact, do you ever wonder where Hamas came from? It was created by the CIA and the Mossad working together to create this Palestinian terrorist organization that threatens the stability of the Near East today. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing is it appears to be. So again, let me make these recommendations. The book, The Devil's Game, the book, See No Evil, and certainly our new DVD on the Financial Armageddon. We recommend this. We have a new DVD, another new DVD on the Trilateral Commission, Pat Wood, going into the background of the Trilateral Commission and how they've been instrumental in bringing about the current financial turmoil. We have the great DVD by Dr. Russell Blaylock, Vaccines and Brain Development. Vaccines and Brain Development. We also carry books by Neil Miller, and you need to understand vaccines because they're going to try to get you to take them when they bring on the next influenza epidemic. And ladies and gentlemen, they do create new diseases. They've created diseases in the past. They've introduced them into the world, like the AIDS epidemic, which we're not trying to stop. And you can go into Africa today, and we've talked recently with Charles Van Vaak and with Peter Hammond from South Africa. 40% of the African adult African population in South Africa are HIV infected, and they're all going to die. In Botswana, 46% of the women there, the pregnant women, are HIV infected, and they're all going to die. And, of course, the people in Botswana want to use standard and effective public health techniques to stop the spread of the disease. And you know what? The World Health Organization won't let them. Oh, no, you can't use the standard effective public health techniques used with all other sexually transmitted diseases because AIDS is different than other diseases, and that's right. AIDS is being used for genocide. And, of course, it is specifically for blacks. This is why in the United States today, almost half of the new AIDS cases are in the black community, which only makes up 13% of the population. Why do you think that is? Because this is a genetically modified disease. Information's all out there, a number of books we carry. Project Daylily, we carry the book AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief, and then we carry we don't carry, but you can get it on Amazon, Full Disclosure by Gary Glum, all telling you about the origin of the disease. Of course, we carry emerging viruses, AIDS, Ebola, and you need to get the information. And then, of course, our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
There are many people asking questions. There are many people asking why. There are many people paying attention. There are many now who
see the big lie, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, the big lie. It's huge. It's bigger every day. But not on the Power Hour, because here we open it up to the light, to the truth, and we evaluate what the news is so that you won't be led astray.